Show everyone, this is Radio Free Nintendo episode 280. I'm your host Jonathan Metz, and with me for now are James Jones.
I'm wearing green because green can make people happy around you, but this is a recorded show, so you can't tell.
And Greg Leahy. John Lindemann will be joining us in just a little bit, we think. And I'm your host Jonathan Metz, and guys, my Wii is glowing.
What?
I just got home a few minutes ago, and the blue light is on, and my Wii is glowing. And I think that is a great indicator of just how crazy today has been in the world of Nintendo.
What is it? What is it? Why is it glowing?
I'm pretty sure it's Hulu Plus. I'm pretty sure.
So, oh, damn it!
Maybe not the most exciting reason for your Wii to return to life.
All right, why are we doing the show again?
Yeah. No, I think it's a message saying, hey, Hulu Plus is here for people who don't regularly go to the Wii Shop channel, which is all of us. Nowadays.
Or read Nintendo's awesome press releases.
Right. Which sometimes I can't even find. And I have press credentials at their website, and I still can't find their press releases all the time. But anyway, I think it's a little too late for Hulu Plus, I think.
A little?
Yeah. I mean, it's been out on other systems for over a year at least, maybe almost two in some cases.
Hey, it's coming to 3DS sometime this year that we're not going to divulge.
Yeah, I can see that as being a little more appealing since it is mobile.
But it's not mobile. It's tethered to Wi-Fi.
Yes, but Wi-Fi is available in places other than your home. But anyway, I think Hulu Plus on Wii is good to have for a lot of people because a lot of people use Netflix on Wii. So I'm just surprised it took this long. And I wonder if maybe it's just that the system isn't powerful enough or they couldn't figure out how to get the interface right or if Netflix had some kind of weird exclusivity, or if they just didn't play right with Nintendo. I don't get it, because Netflix has been on Wii for 3 years or so, and it's really big deal, and I would think that they'd want a piece of that action. Obviously they did, but I just can't believe it took this long.
Well, you know, it's funny, because generally speaking, the Wii is the only device that Netflix tends to mention explicitly.
Yeah.
So you could entirely be on the ball with some kind of weird Nintendo deal.
But yeah, Nintendo made a big deal of that, but we're tiptoeing around the real special thing. I wish my Wii was glowing because they were telling me, Virtual Console is back, baby! But they're probably just going to sweep that under the rug like they always have.
Well, I don't know, have we gotten the press release this week? Because last I checked, we had...
It was hard for me to find this morning. They did finally put it out there. This is actually has been a Thursday ritual for me. I check in the morning. I get up, and pretty much the first thing I do that day is check the press release to find out what came out. As you can imagine, this is often disappointing. But
often?
Every now and then, something crazy happens, and today something crazy happened.
Yeah, we got Hulu Plus.
We got Strider for Genesis on the Wii Virtual Console.
It's true. We've known it's been on the way for quite a while.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it came out in Japan in November, and then Capcom, not long after that, pretty much said that Street Fighter for the Genesis, the one with online, mm-hmm. would make it to the West eventually. So it's kind of surprising, especially after Europe broke its duck a few weeks ago with Prince of Persia and stuff, that it's been this long. But it's reassuring that it's happened.
Yeah, and I'm not expecting regular releases to follow, but it has been a 6 month wait for Virtual Console.
It's really, I mean, I didn't even use the Virtual Console service that much, but it's really depressing to me still. It's like, just put something out.
I like the sort of delicious irony that Strider is a game that conceivably could have been like day one. It's
that kind of game, course.
You know, like Super Castlevania 4 or something. It's that sort of game that's so associated with the platform that it was on.
I actually kind of like Strider for NES in spite of its shittiness, because it is very ambitious and weird and kind of fun to play, even though it's
bad.
It's kind of a bad game. But
kind of.
But it's bad in an entertaining way, and not an ironic way. And the game is actually fun to play, even though you can tell that it's a total mess. And I've never played the Genesis version, not that I can think of. So as much considering I like Strider anyway, I'm really looking forward to this. Once Mass Effect 3 comes out, I will be probably downloading Strider for Genesis. I'm the only person who draws a connection between those two games, but...
Yeah, I've been planning on getting it, but I'll probably have it sooner than like, because obviously been on Japan for a while, but I just haven't got around to it yet.
This initiative of yours to not buy games till Mass Effect 3 comes out is becoming increasingly irrational and increasingly hilarious for me personally.
Well, actually, the funny thing is, I thought it would give me time to catch up on all the games that I had bought.
That hasn't happened.
And, well, I have made progress. I have played games that I wanted to play but didn't have time for. But if you look at my Steam library, it's ugly. I mean, I've still got The Witcher and The Witcher 2 and Civ 5, which some people think is the most addictive, time-consuming game ever made. And I've barely scratched on KOTOR. I'm halfway through Trine and L.A. Noire and all this other stuff, and it's like... When am I going to get to play these games? I mean, I'm trying to start...
I have Xenoblade coming, that's all.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, actually, Xenoblade, I'm almost purposefully... holding out on because of the April release in North America. I feel like it's probably more useful for me to...
I'll have beaten the last story before you touch that game again.
That's fine. I played it for like 10 hours and I liked it. I didn't absolutely adore it quite as much as you, James, or Greg even. But that's not to say it wouldn't grow on me more than it already has, I think.
Well, once you actually get start playing the game.
It was the problem is, it came from, I got it after you guys, and so for me it got here right about the same time as Skyrim and a bunch of other shit hitting the fan in November. So it was just hard to sit down with it for the amount of time that it obviously requires. And I still haven't gone back to it, partially because I feel like it's okay for me to wait at this point. With it coming out here in April, I can talk about it in March and April, and it will actually be relevant, whereas me talking about it in January probably doesn't do anybody any good. So I figured, let's play some other stuff in between, and I'll come back to Xenoblade. Trust me, I will come back to Xenoblade. For all the trouble I went through to get it and make it playable on my system, I'm not nearly done with it. It's just not the highest priority for me right now. But anyway, in the eShop front, even more interesting stuff happening, because Europe got a very important game that Greg's going to talk about in a little bit. But here in North America, we got Super Mario Brothers.
Now explain what Super Mario Brothers this is.
The original Super Mario Brothers for NES was released yes. on Virtual Console for 3DS. For purchase. So yes. The ambassador, the 3DS ambassadors have already had this game for a couple of months. The crappy version with no save states or anything. So now it has been updated for the ambassadors for free. It's a painful process to find the update in the eShop, but you can find the update, you can download the update, and now your version will have a different icon on the home screen for 3DS, and then it will have save state support, which is great. So I don't have a problem with this. I mean, as an ambassador, I don't really care if those games become available for purchase at some point. I think it's good that more people get to play them, and we got our copies for free, so I'm not hating on people for getting something that I got, because they're really not. They're going to have to pay for it.
Because I still have to pay for my parking ticket, so it's fine.
I am a little surprised it happened this early, because I thought they kind of indicated that it would be a little longer before they started doing this for, and they still claim GBA they will never sell.
Sure, yeah, but originally they had said that NES games would be coming before the end of 2011, which was true in Japan. There yes. were Famicom games there. I think Super Mario Brothers and the original Zelda did come out before. And then, of course, there was Punch-Out this year. So, you know, it's not even just limited to the ones that were in the Ambassador Program. But, you know, they're probably, if anything, maybe a little slower than they originally said, considering they only made, like, two games in one territory last year. But what we did see is what we talked about last week. One downloadable release for the eShop, and so if it's Super Mario Brothers, it isn't Wario Land that we got over here.
Right. And that's kind of my problem with it, because as much as I'm fine with Super Mario Brothers being for sale, and I think they'll sell a lot of copies of it, I would rather have Wario Land 3, because that's a much more rare game, it's a much more difficult to get game, and it's a game that I don't already have on my 3DS. So obviously I would have a preference for that. But still, you know, and then of course we got a new demo, which is always kind of a big deal. We haven't gotten as many of them in the US as Europe and Japan have. So that's significant too, and Greg's gonna talk about that right now.
Transitions!
Yeah, sure. I'll start. Well,
oh, that smooth segue. Ooh.
Yeah, I hate to put a bit of friction in here, but I do. I'll go to something else first. Cause,
it's a little sand in the ointment, huh?
Well, Last Story's coming out next week.
Yes.
And then we also had the release date announcement for Pandora's Tower, which is coming out in April, April the 13th.
So it will also beat Xenoblade.
What? No. It's a week later, isn't it?
Oh, I thought it was the week. I thought it was the same week.
I thought it was April the 6th or something. It's really close anyway. But okay, so, yeah. That's pretty funny. And it's nice in a way that we know, you know, when these games are coming out. It's not too far in the distance because there hasn't been a lot of Wii games. Especially for me, I've obviously Xenoblade in the past for me. Rhythm Heaven's quite a long way in the past for me.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that is, good Lord, what will be after Pandora's Tower?
Nothing!
I mean, Mario Party 9 even is going to be out by then, and, you know, like Poke Park and all this stuff. Like, I mean,
Park 2, get it straight.
Yeah.
We'll get emails.
Beyond the World or whatever it is. You know, after Pandora's
Beyond
Tower,
playable.
I just see utter desolation. And
oh, yeah, it's... It's the,
I
it's
really,
the Gobi.
I don't know if we're going to get some surprise games in a sort of quarterly release schedule at some point to pad it a little before we get to the end of the year.
If we do, they can't be anything that substantial. I mean, think about what the GameCube was like in that last 6 months. Or God, the N64.
Yeah, but this is different. This is a market-leading console. They're not sort of getting off it as quickly as they possibly could. So I don't know whether it might be a bit less grim than that. But yeah, right now you just look at it and think, good Lord.
I mean, that they could conceivably go all the way to E3 without having announced any games, though. And
there
then
will
go.
Be a new Madden in August. We just heard that last week. I don't know that anyone's really surprised, but...
Yeah, well, you get Madden, but not Tiger. You know, right. Tiger, the other reliable staple of the Wii, isn't even making it. And that was one of the best Wii games I played last year, so that is a significant loss for this year's software library.
It's my dad's favorite Wii game, that's for sure.
So I just thought I'd mention that. I mean, I don't know whether I'm going to be getting either of the latter Operation Rainfall games. Yeah, I'm kind of waiting for reviews on Last Story to see if I'm going to sort of get into it.
Last Story, obviously, I've already bought, but I was sold on. But yeah, Pandora's Tower, I
don't understand much about that game.
It's messed up.
Well, I know the story is really weird, but I don't actually know how the game plays very much. I don't know much about it.
It seems a lot like Castlevania, Lords of Shadow. You know, I mean, there's some definite similarities there, which is a game that I liked. So in some ways, it's like, well, I might enjoy it, but on the other hand, do I really have the appetite for that sort of thing, having already played a game that was very satisfying in that regard, I found, with Castlevania for PS3. So I'm not sure about that one, but I mean, it certainly, compared to, you know, as I said, the desolation of the release schedule, you know, it's a significant
game. That game becomes a 10 because of nothing left.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Lindemann is here.
A pleasure to be here, as always, Johnny.
Thank you for joining us. Yes, Greg was just giving us an update on the European releases coming up. So, Greg, why don't you tell us about what you've been playing on your 3DS?
Another transition!
Yep. First of all, I did pick up the WarioLand release today. So this is obviously the next in the line. If this was still called Super Mario Land 3.
Oh, is that the one that came out?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was Wario Land 3. I must have just read the press release wrong.
Well, this is the problem when you have the word land in twice.
Oh, yeah.
Super Mario Land, World Land.
I'm a little less jealous because I thought this was the Game Boy Color exclusive Wario Land 3, which is an amazing late GBC platformer. But I still want to play the first Wario Land.
Yeah, I actually have the cartridge for the third one, as it happens.
I do somewhere.
But I'm very eager to play all of them, really, having enjoyed the Wario Land games that I have played. And I like Super Mario Land 2 as well, as we discussed when that came out. So yeah, it is the next one in the sequence. And that's very much apparent when you play it. You could tell it's a sort of in the middle of a transition between Super Mario Land 2, you know, being still a very much a Mario game, although a bit weird in many ways, and then where they went with Wario Land 2 and 3, where it was a lot more kind of puzzle driven and he was invincible and you kind of did all these weird things to him to give him different powers and all this kind of stuff. This is still much more orthodox than that. You know, his health and stuff is very much more Mario. You know, you shrink down to little Wario, or you can get power up hats, you can breathe fire with the dragon hat, or you can sort of glide through the air with the jet hat, which is, that's pretty cool. I like that power quite a lot. But at this point, it's definitely very much not a Mario game anymore. I mean, he doesn't really handle anything like Mario. The run button isn't there. You know, he's a lot heavier and more stiff. I mean, there's still a certain amount of exploration, especially as it relates to some of these sort of treasure chests that you find in the levels where they'll be locked behind a door and you've got to find a key somewhere to unlock them and then get the chest. But the thing is, that can often involve backtracking or this kind of thing. I'm not exactly sure what those bits of treasure are going to do at the end of the game, whether it's going to have...
I wouldn't expect too much.
Yeah, maybe it's just going to be like a grade, like the end of Luigi's Mansion or something, you know, how big your mansion is or whatever. But it definitely adds a little bit of something into the mix, because other than that, you know, it is, to my mind, you're significantly more straightforward than the other Wario Land games I've played, but it's still fun. And I obviously haven't played that much of it yet, although I don't think it's a terribly long game, but right. I've enjoyed what I've played, and it's a little tricky in places so far, and the bosses are cool and completely mad, but which is always nice.
Being that this is the first game that let you play as Wario, do you get a sense of the craziness of the weird personality and the strange sense of humor that has sort of become synonymous with Wario in the more recent years?
Yeah, it just hasn't got the full weirdness and sort of buffoonery going, I don't think, quite yet. I mean, obviously, it sort of limited the original Game Boy in terms of it doesn't have as much of expressive animation as he does in the GBC game that I played, for instance. And certainly when you take it on to Wario Land 4 or Shake It, or I mean, they couldn't quite sort of fit that in there. But of course, it is about money. That part of it was laid down that Wario is...
In a sense, so is Super Mario Brothers. I mean,
yeah,
I think that's sort of the sly commentary by Nintendo on their own games, is that it's like, it's very easy to say, well, now it's all about collecting treasure. And then you think, wait a minute, Mario just collects coins and always has.
To exchange with extra life with God.
But in this case, first of all, I mean, you've got hearts that function the way coins did for Mario. So, you know, the coins don't get you an extra life with Wario. And then with the coins themselves, you get this weird kind of gambling sort of aspect to it at the end of the level. So you can actually double your money at the end. But on the other hand, if you sort of, it's just a sort of random thing. If you pick like the wrong option, then like this weight just falls on your head and then you actually, your money gets halved. I assume there's some sort of grading maybe or something that's going to happen at the end of the game based on how much money you actually end up with, because it just keeps, you know, accumulating as you go. And there's also things like you have to pay to set up a mid-level checkpoint. You could actually use big... I think you could just, like, pluck a big coin out and, like, throw it at things and whatnot. So yes, there's definitely a difference between how money's handled here. The whole idea of it being greedy and all that is apparent. But you could tell that the Wario Land games definitely came a long way once they started doing 2 and 3. But it doesn't make this less fun. I've enjoyed it so far, and I think by next week, I probably would have finished it and I'd be able to sort of deliver a final verdict, as it were. But the other thing that I did pick up was the Metal Gear Solid 3D demo. So I've never played a Metal Gear game.
Oh boy.
There was the whole issue of them, first of all, being on PlayStation.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the Metal Gear Solid ones anyway. And then when you got to Twin Snakes, all that kind of stuff, it's just never really struck me as being the kind of game that I would necessarily like all that much. I mean, obviously it's sort of infamous for having really protracted cutscenes that are kind of guff. Just it seems like its priorities are in a place that mine aren't.
Well, I mean, 4 is the worst for that.
So that's the thing. With 3, I've been thinking about giving it a chance from the point of view that everyone, virtually, it seems to be pretty broad consensus that this is the best game in the series.
But that's not to say it's any less weird or off-putting than the other ones.
Yeah.
There is a notable scene where you climb a ladder for about 2.5 minutes while a song plays. Yeah.
Not pretentious at all.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's
that's
not...
if John made a game, but it would all be gangster
Well, that's
rap.
The thing. I climb it for 5 minutes. So
I thought it'd be sort of climbing it to Hearts on Fire from the Rocky IV soundtrack.
I'm not making the game. Come on.
The entire Footloose soundtrack?
This is the issue. You know, I'm still not sold by any means because that's a kind of game that doesn't really appeal to me. But, you know, like I said, this has got the advantage of being good, seemingly, at least at what it does. And it's a prequel, so you're not being thrown right in the middle of some batshit nuttery.
Well, you are, but you don't need to know what the Lolly Lule Lo are. No.
if you... So I thought, let's have an open mind about this and try the demo. Now, the first thing with the demo is it does support the Circle Pad Pro.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried that, and then using the Pro, the controls are pretty much sort of standard third-person shooter controls, which is fine.
Is the camera perspective behind Snake?
You have a choice about that.
Okay.
I was having it as a sort of over-the-shoulder kind of thing, but you can go into first person, at which point the 3D automatically switches off. So I assume there's something there about using the gyro. Because the other time the 3D automatically switches off is when you're going over a bridge and it wants you to use the gyro to balance Snake.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Clearly, it takes it out of your hands. It doesn't want you to have to kind of feel obliged to slide it down at certain points or deal with the losing of the image. It just sort of all does it for you.
That's good. But you're saying you can essentially play the whole demo in first person?
No, I think when you're aiming.
Oh, only when you're aiming. Sure, sure.
Instead of aiming behind the shoulder RE4 style, which is what I was doing.
Oh, so the camera choice is only for when you're aiming.
Yes.
I see. Because the original version of Metal Gear Solid 3 was, like the first two games, primarily played from an overhead perspective. So this is probably more likely based on the subsistence version, which was the re-release of sort of expanded version, director's cut of Metal Gear Solid 3. Well, that's the one I played, and I did like it. I remember thinking some of the boss fights would have been very difficult and very different to play if they were more of the over-the-top view from the first game. So I'm not surprised especially because it's 3D. Having that perspective into the direction that Snake is facing is going to give them more opportunities to use the 3D effect. And frankly, I think it's just more playable. I mean, you can just see the game world better from that perspective. But I'm curious if they're going to provide an option in the final version of the game to play it in the original camera style, which would be overhead.
Yeah, hard to say. I mean, as you say, there's a number of things in terms of also, I think, being on a lower res kind of environment. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether if you're kind of more zoomed out, it all blends together a bit. I mean, some people have commented on that maybe being an issue as it is, you know, with the 3DS game.
I found it to be very difficult to distinguish facts in the E3 demo.
I mean, from what I played here, you know, and it's pretty much a nothing demo. I mean, it's a bit of cutscenes, not a whole lot, you know, a bit of codec conversations. Ugh. You sneak around for a little bit, you get to a room, and it just says, thanks for playing.
It's a very Japanese-style demo.
Is it the start where you're crawling through the swamp?
Yes.
Okay, so it's probably the exact same area as the E3 demo.
I would assume so. That's what we've seen with RE as well. You know, that was pretty much the E3 demo, so it seems to be how publishers are handling this sort of thing. But anyway, I mean, in terms of the 3D effect, I thought it was pretty effective, actually. There's a kind of double-edged sword. On the one hand, the fact that you've got a game that, in many ways, would be better suited to something higher res and a bigger screen because, you know, you're in these sort of very dense environments where, you know, it's all brown and green, you know, it's all organic and stuff, so you can actually sort of distinguish those fine details. The one good thing about that on 3DS is that ghosting is much less apparent in 3D. You know, the high contrast is the death of, you know, for ghosting, isn't it? You know, that, when you get this is something that happens in Resident Evil Revelations.
Bittrip Saga is,
yeah, that
really bad
because
that's literally white pixels on black backgrounds.
Yes,
so
there is a lot of ghosting in that game.
So, I mean, that's the thing. With RE, which has great visuals, and I think I didn't really mention this during my previous discussion of the game, but I think the 3D effect is very good in that. I was very pleased with it. I played with it on the entire time. But because sometimes you have the lighting, which is one of the game's strengths, does create these kind of high contrast situations where the ghosting is really apparent and kind of distracting. It's sort of like Metal Gear, especially in this part of the demo here in the jungle environment, it's not apparent at all because everything's kind of just too similar to each other. It all kind of blends. Literally, you are trying to get the main character to blend in with the environment. That is the one good thing. You get this sense of depth and, all the different layers of vegetation kind of sticking up and all that, but without being distracted by the ghosting or anything. So I think it could, the 3D part of it could work in that sense quite nicely. But, I mean, obviously, with such a trivial slice of the game, really, other than being able to say that, yes, it does look quite nice and the controls seem fine if you've got a pro, which is, a pretty big caveat there. Obviously, yeah. I already have
one. On that point, did you play it without the pro?
I've yet to do that.
You should
have fun.
I might have a go for a laugh. But remember, the demo only came out today, so I've only had time to play it.
The E3 demo last year, before anyone knew the Circle Pad Pro existed, was pretty atrocious to control.
Oh, I beat it just before we went to the interview and just sat there and couldn't say anything. I was going to be like, how? Why?
Well, I don't know to what extent they could fix the non-pro scheme, but the existence of the pro does somewhat mitigate against that, doesn't it? It's a crutch, you don't have to so
much. Well, it would, but the decisions they made, and I don't want to spoil them for you, I want you to enjoy them, but the decisions they made on how you should control it are befuddling.
Yeah, well, certainly Metal Gear fans are crazy, and if they really want to play this game on 3DS, I don't think they will have any problem getting a Circle Pad Pro to do it.
I want to speak about that because during the interview with the game's producer, we were greeted with questions like, oh, you changed the frogs during that scene and other such things.
Yeah.
And then they want to know why. Like, there was some deep symbolic meaning in the changing of the frogs.
Okay, so James, what do you have for new business this week?
So I went through and knocked out the remainder of Rhythm Heaven for the review, which is now posted, which we'll probably talk about now playing. I really enjoy the game. I guess I was at about through the fourth set of games when I talked about it last week, or 10. And I really felt like towards the end where they start reshuffling things and bringing remixes together, that the game's presentation really went through the roof. There's a really... I mean, it's a J-pop song that they've localized into English, so the lyrics are kind of weird because they had to make them fit the beat patterns and stuff. But there is a remarkably well-themed remix that they've basically rebranded every game that they include in this. It's like 5 or 6 games from earlier in the actual package. And they essentially rebranded them as like a music video set, and everything's in red and black colors. It's really visually striking. And even though these games were obviously conceived separate from this remix, everything fits into the beat patterns of that song. It's really, really impressive. And presentationally speaking, this game is unbelievable. just the sheer amount of work this team must have put into making all these little presentation cues sync so nicely. I can't even understand how they did it. And to be honest, I say this in the review, but there's no point in owning any other party games for your Wii. Like, if you ever have friends over, this should be the only game you need.
Nice. Okay.
And because, the beauty of it is...
I wouldn't have thought of the game as serving that purpose, but since I want to get it anyway, it'd be nice to have a party game that is actually new that I might not be embarrassed to show to people.
It does have a limited multiplayer. It has a limited multiplayer mode. I think it's like 10 of the games were two-player, which is just ridiculous. I mean, two-player Karate Man is bizarre. But... even when you're not playing, when someone's watching or when you're watching someone play, there's so much going on screen. Details you might not even notice while you're playing. For example, there's a game where you kick balls that are bouncing towards weasels, although they're buried underground. I don't think weasels burrow, so I don't know what the game's doing there. But you're kicking balls to prevent them from running into their den. So basketballs and soccer balls, you kick them, they just go away. But when you kick footballs, roughly 2 or 3 seconds later, way out in the background, you'll see them fall into the horizon, and then something, a football player in the first remix, but really random stuff in the second one, jump up and grab them And it, as you, the more you get, the weirder the stuff grabbing them gets. If you're playing the game, you're probably too focused to notice that the first couple times.
Yeah, I think it's a dual purpose kind of thing. I mean, I do think part of it is just trying to put you off.
Oh, yeah, it's trying to mess with
you. If you do notice it and you find it funny, it's basically trying to screw
with you. It's
going to
get you.
And then on the other hand, yeah, if someone's just watching, it's additional entertainment for them.
Oh, I mean, I think Remix 10. Which is the last remix of the game.
Which is everything.
Yeah, it literally is everything, including a menu thing you play before you start the game to teach you what rhythm is.
Yes.
I had forgotten what you do when that thing comes up. I was like, what is this? I don't remember this. And then I failed it. It took me something like 30 tries to get through Remix 10, because it goes for 3 minutes 40 seconds.
It's a long one, that. Oh, yes. But that's... I mean, if you're a Rhythm Heaven guy, they always do this. That's always right. The ending, is everything strung together. And I always look forward to it. I love the latter remixes where they... You know, the way the structure goes, you have 4 songs and a remix, 4 songs and a remix.
Right.
You know that the remix is going to draw upon those 4 songs. You have an expectation. But once you get to the point where you go sort of off the map, right, and the remixes could draw on a broader sort of range, I absolutely love those ones. When it just gets more and more surprising and more disparate. It obviously, it's more challenging, first of all, but it's even more satisfying when you actually keep up with it and it all comes together. It's a great culmination.
Yeah, a lot of the remixes, when they've only got 4 songs, you can sort of hack your way through it by just getting piece by piece together. But Remix 10, I counted on one of my attempts to clear it, has 31 different sections.
Oof. Wow.
I mean, you can't memorize that. It's 31 sections. You just have to get really, really good at all of the games and just be able to react instantly.
Yeah, you're just going on instinct, right?
Yeah, eventually what'll happen is you won't be able to say in order what happens, but you'll kind of be able to say, okay, after this, just instinctively know what's coming next.
And that's how I feel a lot about the WarioWare games, too. I mean, same team, obviously, but, you know, when you're playing through the story mode, you kind of have an idea of what games might show up in a given stage, but you don't know what order and you don't know what difficulty, and they're all these little variations that they could have based on when they show up. And I find a lot of times I just try not to even predict what's going to come up, because that'll throw me off when I'm wrong. It's better to just kind of zone out and not think about it, and then just deal and just be ready to, you know, have your reflexes ready to go regardless of what comes up, and hope that it's not a game you've never seen before, because then you're probably screwed.
What I thought was really interesting about this, I read the Iwata Ask as I was working on the review. I thought it was interesting how they describe making these games together, you know, like the philosophy that comes in when they're making this. So TDX, I think, is the name of the company. Or TNX, can't remember.
I think it's TNX, yeah.
Are they the music company or the music label?
Well, they're a multimedia company. So
oh, okay.
The person who's the lead designer of this game works there. I think he's basically the boss of that company.
Oh.
So he wrote the songs and then hands them off to people. And then they just come up with whatever it makes them feel. Like whatever kind of artwork they think goes with it. And they bring it back. And that's just it. That he doesn't override them, so they come back with stuff. And he was talking about how he'd write this really Japanese-themed song, and they'd come back with prawns. And he just goes, okay, well, we're gonna have prawns then.
Well, I remember interviewing – this was years ago. I interviewed someone at E3 named Abe. His last name was Abe. I don't remember his first name. But he was on the WarioWare team, and I think he worked very closely with Sakamoto probably. And we were asking him, how do you come – I mean, there's so many ideas in this game. How do you organize them? How do you come up with all this stuff? What's your process like when you get ready to do a Wario game, a WarioWare game? How do you even start that expedition? And he said, we get everybody together at this big conference table, and we spend, let's say, 15, 20 minutes having everybody write down ideas on Post-it notes. And it could be an idea for a gameplay mechanic, or it could be an idea for an art style, or some kind of scenario that maybe you could build a game around. And then we take those and we basically shuffle them up and just mix them up in a big pile and go through them and start to just basically keep the ones that we think are funny. And then we throw everything else out. And that's how they come up with what games are going to be in a WarioWare. I mean, it is that chaotic. It's that random almost. It's just a huge brainstorming thing. And there's very little editing process. There's no design document You know, I mean, there's none of that. It's just, hey, everybody, come up with the craziest ideas you can think of, and we'll probably put most of them in the game.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It's just, it feels like the people who created this game aren't really game designers. They're more artists. Like, no, not in that sense. Like if somebody were to tell me games aren't art, I would say this game is kind of art. I mean,
yeah, sort of like interactive art.
Everything is synergized into the vision of the maybe three people who really drove this game. The guy who has the male symbol in his name.
Is it Sunku, is it?
Sunku, yeah. Sunku, male symbol. But again, I really encourage people to read the Iwata Asks, because damn, if Iwata was a journalist, he'd kill us at our jobs.
But doesn't he already know the answers?
Well, no, I mean, I think
he has kind of an unfair advantage, doesn't he?
A lot of times, though, he seems legitimately surprised by their answers. Like he's like, "Well, really?"
Legitimately amused, Stephen.
Yeah, there's a lot of parentheses laughs.
So he does laugh. Hmm. Aside from evil cackles on a pile of money.
I think I've read plenty of Iwata Asks, and I think his questions are often not pedestrian, but expected. And I think the answers are often very enlightening. And I think, number one, it's partly because these people prepare more for these interviews than they do for when they interview with us. And number two, a lot of these are just people you don't hear from because Nintendo doesn't allow all that many outside interviews with its developers. So Iwata just has the access because he's the boss and because he does this feature. He just gets to talk to people who you normally don't hear from. And a lot of times they have very interesting things to say and very interesting perspectives on game development that we're not exposed to otherwise. And so it makes him come across as a really great interviewer. I think if you look at the questions themselves, they're not really that special. You know, I mean, you sit me in a room with Sakamoto and I could pump out a pretty sweet interview, okay? That's never going to happen because it's Nintendo.
I do find the picture, though, of him sitting around the table with people who work at TNX to be amusing, because as you can guess, they're all multimedia people. There's not a suit to be seen, but then Iwata's sitting in what is clearly a freshly pressed black suit.
Yeah.
But the other guy has a male symbol in his name, so yeah.
Because he's more butch than Prince.
Oh, this guy is more effeminate than anyone, ever.
Okay, so I'll go next with new business. I have a smorgasbord as usual, a kind of weird mixture of stuff. First off, I did play a little bit of Mario Kart Super Circuit from the Ambassador program. It was the first time I booted it up. And I remember hearing on Connectivity a couple months ago, they were talking about the Mario Kart series. I was on one of those segments defending the honor of Double Dash. But they had another one where I think it was Andrew Brown from Australia was kind of defending his argument that Super Circuit is the best game. A lot of people say it's probably the worst. Or it's certainly one of the least played of the series. But he was saying it's the best, and primarily because it had the best single-player experience. And I think, you know, it makes sense that Nintendo, or Intelligent Systems in this case, would put more emphasis on the single-player mode for this GBA game because it was fairly difficult to get people together to play it multiplayer. You know, this was the first portable game in the series. You had to have multiple copies. For the most, I mean, you could play it with a single copy, but not much. It was very limited. You needed multiple systems, which was hard to pull together. You needed all these crazy link cables. And I think they knew that this wasn't going to happen often enough for it to be the keystone of the series as it had been, especially for the N64 game. More so than the Super Nintendo one. And also, you know, considering it was chosen for the Ambassador program and there are no multiplayer features available on the 3DS version because there's no link cable port and they didn't put in any kind of net code for it or anything like that. So you can only play this game single player on your 3DS. So if it is the best single player Mario Kart, then it seems like maybe a good choice. I don't think it is the best single-player Mario Kart. I don't even think it's a good Mario Kart game from what I played of it, which wasn't a lot, but I played it for a couple hours. I think it looks nice. I think it makes very good use of the GBA hardware, and the tracks, of course, are a lot flatter than the 64 game. But I don't know that they're more complicated than the Super Nintendo game. They're definitely more curvy than I remember Super Mario Kart being.
They're all about cornering because that's what you've got. You know, you can't do undulations in the track, so you've basically got to have corners.
And the straightaways aren't as interesting as they are in, let's say, F-Zero, where you might actually do some drafting and pick up some speed and use a boost. If you think about it on a straightaway, especially in the older Mario Kart games, straightaways are really boring because unless you have a weapon, there's not really anything you can do. And if you have a weapon, it can almost be too easy to use your weapon and knock somebody out. So they just, especially in this game, there don't seem to be many straightaways at all. And I think they're also limited in the map size they could use because of the technology. So they really wanted to be kind of dense with track designs because they have certain square footage that they have available to them. So they want to fill it up as much as possible. And the way you do that is by snaking the track around itself a lot. And the problem with that is the turning is really bad in this game. It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like other Mario Kart games, but also doesn't feel good at all.
It goes back to what we were saying with Maximum Velocity when James played that. You know, it is very different. And going back to it, having played several Mario Karts hence,
including one on the same system as I'm playing Super Circuit.
I mean, especially, you know, Mario Kart DS, played a lot of that. That's got D-pad controls as well, and it feels very different. Very, very different indeed. Yes. So it's difficult just to get acclimated. Now, in terms of how good or bad it is in a more kind of absolute sense, once you cast that adjustment process aside, it's hard for me to say.
I couldn't adjust to it.
I mean, that's tough in itself. And it clearly, I think you have to concede that it's just not as immediate as other Mario Kart. So given the kind of game that Mario Kart is, I think being immediate is important. Mm-hmm. So it's a strike against it in that sense, I think, very legitimately straight off the bat. I mean, I recall I did play it to death when I had it as a one-player game. I ended up getting you can get 3-star ranks, and you know, I did eventually get the 3-star ranks for all the new tracks. Having done that, you know, I think the track design in terms of perfecting a racing line and all that kind of stuff, it does have quite a lot to commend about it. And also, it's not as crazy with the items, you know. I mean, basically,
I agree with that. Yeah, they seem very toned down compared to some other games in the series.
If you want to get a 3-star ranking, you basically cannot be hit with an item at all. Now, that is very harsh, but at the same time, the fact that it's even feasible demonstrates that it's very, very different than some more recent iterations. And I can imagine.
There is a blue shell. I don't know if you can.
There is a blue shell, yeah, but it's very much less frequent. And most of the time, you can block incoming fire if you've got a banana, you know, hanging out the back there, or a shell or whatever defensively. So, in that sense, it is more focused on racing than some other Mario Karts. And I think that's why it has some people that really, really like it and would defend it as a single-player Mario Kart. For me, it's difficult because I played it to death more than 10 years ago, and I have not touched it since. And it's really difficult to say where it ranks, other than to say it is less accessible. And I think that's not a good thing for a Mario Kart game. I think it should be the kind of game that even if, say, you've played a lot of it, but you want to introduce it to some friends, they should be able to pick it up really quickly and be, you know, somewhat proficient at it. And so you can all have fun. And I struggle, you know, even link cable bullshit aside, I struggle to see that happening with Super Circuit.
Right. Yeah, I found that the game just often subverted my expectations for how it should feel. I found that the shoulder button sliding, I couldn't find any use for it whatsoever. Maybe there's some real high-level play where that comes in, but it feels completely different than even the 64 game, which I'm fine at. You know, I'm pretty good at power sliding in 64 and in Double Dash, which came after this. But this game, it feels like it swings you really far out in the turn.
Yes.
Maybe you keep up a little more speed, but you're going to sacrifice just distance that you're covering so much that I didn't really understand.
A lot of it is about where you initiate it.
Yeah.
And essentially the way it works, you are going to initiate it at a point in the turn that's rather different from what you would in any other Mario Kart game.
Right.
That's about as best as I can sort of describe it from my memory.
There's so many things about this game that just don't feel right. And I guess, you know, if you played it for 30 hours like you probably did back in the day and like other people maybe did when they didn't have much other stuff going on with Game Boy Advance, maybe you just get used to this stuff over time, but I feel like my first impression of the game was rather poor, and I just don't feel like I would ever be able to stand playing it long enough to ever get all that stuff out. I mean, I haven't even played 7 all that much, just because it's just not as compelling to me as I was hoping for. It's just not a game that draws me back. I mean, I could go back, I could play it online every night. There's other things I'd rather be doing. It's not that appealing to me for some reason. But still, I like 7 way better than this. I mean, when I play 7, I'm having a lot more fun than I did when I was playing Super Circuit. So it's interesting. I mean, this is pretty much the first time I've played it. I think I did a few Yoshi battles with a friend back in the early 2000s who had his copy. So I have played it before, but it's been a very long time. I played it very little back then. So this is really my first exposure, and it's kind of living down to its reputation for me, which is too bad.
It's interesting because, I mean, that got fantastic reviews when it came out across the board.
I don't remember that.
Look them up. They are glowing. So people were able to adjust ultimately and enjoy it. And the fact perhaps that it was more leveraged on single player than some Mario Karts is probably a good thing for reviews, because, you know, you might not always be able to get the most out of multiplayer in a sort of condensed review timetable. So I think that probably plays a role, but the perception of it has shifted.
Its overall score is 93 on Metacritic.
I remember at the time, you know, I wasn't a huge Mario Kart fan. I wasn't crazy about it like some people were. And that was part of the formula for me not picking it up. But the other thing was, the same year, I had rented F-Zero Maximum Velocity and had played it to death over a weekend at least. And I bought Konami Crazy Racers, which I still to this day think is really good kart racer. It was pretty much a launch title, or came out right after the launch for GBA. And so I didn't really feel like I wanted another kart racer from Nintendo. And I felt like I was very satisfied with Konami Crazy Racers and the aesthetic of it, you know, the really ridiculous menage of characters, kind of the Smash Brothers of racing games in terms of just bizarre things in there. I think you can play as a Moai head from Gradius. You can play as Goemon from the Mystical Ninja series. And it is a lot of weird stuff like that. And the track designs are super strange. I just thought it was really great. And so I felt satisfied and didn't need to pick up Mario Kart. Now I'm kind of glad that I skipped it. Sorry to say. Also this week, the other thing I'll talk about is I did pick up downloaded the Mass Effect 3 demo. So this is my obviously highly anticipated game of the spring. It is the game for which I am willing to wait on a lot of other things, because I've actually had this pre-order for about 6 months already on Amazon. The demo just came out this week, and I liked it. I liked it. The graphics are definitely a big step up from the second game, which were already a pretty big step up from the first game. And one thing I'm not going to talk about the story stuff, because I know some people, we actually got an email from someone who was saying that he doesn't want to play the demo because he'd rather experience the story stuff for the first time when he has the full game. And I can respect that. I understand with a story-based game, there could be some hesitation to play a demo because, you know, for one thing, whatever you do in there, you're going to have to do it again when you get the final game. And yep. The other thing is, it is going to spoil you to some extent, at least, as far as what's going on with the game. If you're really trying to shield yourself from the story setup, then playing the demo will spoil that, because it is of the very beginning of the game. It appears to be, at least, the very, very beginning of the game. You play that for about 20 minutes, maybe. You have some cutscenes, a little bit of dialogue, and then some action. And then it skips forward to a point somewhere later in the story, and you just to give you a different environment and a little more action. And I liked both parts of it. I thought the setup for the first part is a little strange, considering what my character went through in the last game. And I wonder, you know, with the import function where they're going to take your save data from Mass Effect 1 and 2 and import it here, I wonder if that's going to give me a different experience when I play the final game, because the demo just starts you from blank. You can't import anything. So basically, you create a brand new character. And that was also an interesting experience, because I played the first two games as Male Shepard with a certain face, and I played it as a good guy. so I was a Paragon. And so I figured, well, for the demo, since I'm going to be playing through some of this stuff again later, why don't I just make a character who's the complete opposite? So I made Bitch Shepherd. I made the female asshole Shepherd for the demo. And I've heard a lot of people say this is the best way to play the Mass Effect series, actually, because Jennifer Hale, the voice of Samus also, she does the voice of female Shepherd, and she is very good. I was pretty impressed, even within the demo, the short confines of the demo. I liked her delivery, and I liked, you know, I was picking, like, the most, for these initial scenes, or at least for the demo, there are usually only two different options for dialogue. Mass Effect usually has three or four, at least. But this is simplified, so I was picking the one that was clearly, like, the more dickish thing to say at any given time. And it's interesting, because the way that, the thing that she actually says when you choose those options is not over-the-top, crazy, roguish, you know? She's not like, it doesn't sound like she's intentionally trying to incite people's anger, or she's not totally flippant towards the other characters.
Oftentimes, the rogue statements are laconic.
Yeah, it's more subtle than that, and I really liked her delivery. It was still within the character. Like, it didn't, you know, even, and especially considering it's a totally different sex and totally different voice actor, I still felt like she sort of embodied what Commander Shepard is supposed to be about, but she just kind of got there in a different way, and I liked it. I liked it. I mean, I'm still going to stick with my character, but for a long time, I've thought about going back and playing through Mass Effect 2 again as a rogue female Shepherd, just to see how different the experience is. And the only thing that stopped me is that it's hard for me to justify the time to do that when I could be playing other games I haven't beaten at all. But I really am tempted to do it, just because I do feel like it would be a pretty different story. You know, it'd be a pretty different game. But the demo was kind of a taste of it, at least. And that was fun to do. And, you know, if other people are out there thinking about whether or not they should play the demo, I'd say, you know, that's one way to do it. And also, you know, the story events that play out in the demo could end up being a lot different if you're importing your own character, because they're going to have made different decisions in the past. It's not necessarily a spoiler. But yeah, I enjoyed the demo. I thought the action was good. Did not see the reintroduction of RPG elements that they've sort of been talking up. You know, they say that this will be a little more on the RPG side than Mass Effect 2 was, but I don't see it in the demo. So I don't know how they're actually doing that. I don't know if it's just lip service and they're just psyching people out. There was no inventory whatsoever in the demo. So no armor, nothing to equip. So I really don't know how they're planning to win back some of the RPG purists who were really annoyed by Mass Effect 2. Although it's funny, in listening to podcasts and reading articles about it, a lot of the people who said they were very upset about the direction Mass Effect 2 took away from RPG elements also said it was one of their favorite games of the year.
Well, I mean, you can still say it was a great game, but I really wish they had left this stuff in.
But yeah, if they had, maybe it wouldn't have been such a great game. I mean, I think it's very clear that Mass Effect 2 is a huge improvement over the first one. And I think part of that is because they did streamline. I think the first game is very bulky and over-designed, and especially some of the inventory stuff is a total mess.
Yeah, it takes a lot of upkeep, definitely.
But the second game was my favorite game of that year on any platform, and that's why I'm so excited about the third one. And the demo was encouraging, so I'm pretty happy. It's about a month out now. That's going to be a big day. What actually scares me is all the purchases that I've sort of queued up in my mind. Be a lot of downloads. I want to get Mutant Muds and Strider and a few other things, but what else will I be unable to resist after 3 months of not buying games? That's a little scary, but we'll see how it goes. So, John, wrap it up, please.
Yeah, I actually wrapped up God of War 3, amazingly enough. Another one off the backlog. Let me just say this. God of War 3, it's the kind of game where I don't think the God of War series is that bro-y. Like, you can't really lump it in with, like, Gears of War, Halo, or
it's
any of those
a little
kind of
bro-y.
It's a little bit bro-y.
There are scenes they publicize of him sitting in bed with a bunch of topless women.
Yeah, but that's more campy than bro-y,
right? I don't know. It's...
And the thing is, Kratos, yeah, he's a big, buff, ridiculous, like, Clint Eastwood sort of guy. But the thing is, that game, it's more about, you know, just kind of how everything is huge you know, massive bosses, massive this, everything. It's so in your face. Like, I feel like playing God of War 3 especially, just because, you know, everything is so pretty. The game is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And they can do so much with just the huge, like, character models and everything. But it's just so in your face that I just felt like when I was done with it, I just wanted to, like, go somewhere in a quiet room.
Turn on some NPR.
Yeah, and just relax. Because it's just like that game just completely blows your hair back all the time.
Oh, it's All Things Considered. There we go.
So, John, let me get your opinion on something, because I feel like it's a potential problem with that game and with other games too, that there's not really enough pace, there's not enough lumpiness in terms of what the game does. I mean, one mm-hmm. of the things about God of War is it is very much turned up to 11 all the time. It's really intense nonstop, yeah. And it just constantly throws you from one insane battle against some giant thing to another. And it gets to the point mm-hmm. where it all starts to blend together because nothing stands out. It's very consistently over the top.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been that long since I played God of War 3, but I honestly don't remember anything about how that game ends. You know, I don't mm-hmm. remember most of the big encounters in the game. I remember some of the platforming where you're like swinging through things. You're kind of using your hooks as a grappling thing. And I remember fighting the Titan, but that's like halfway through it, I think. So I think it's potentially a problem because it makes it difficult for the game to create memorable moments when they try to make every moment memorable.
Yeah, there's really no kind of ebbs to the action. It's action all the way through. And I think the first game did it really well, even though I haven't played the first game in a long time. But I thought the first game was like there weren't too many boss battles, but that was almost okay because then the boss battles became really, really meaningful. Mm-hmm. And they were really kind of like, wow, this is really, really cool. But, you know, God of War 3, it's like, you're absolutely right. It just all blends into one action extravaganza. But the thing is, I felt like the ending, like it's weird because the game is so quickly paced, but then the ending, it's kind of drawn out because you fight Zeus, then you fight him again, and then you have this entire sequence where you're like, you're running through the dark. Zeus is about to kill Kratos, but then Kratos like gets in touch with the hope that's deep down in his soul.
Oh, so it's Dragon Ball Z. Perfect.
But I swear to God, you're doing it for like 5 minutes straight. And it's just, it slows the whole game down. It's just a really weird ending. But yeah, the other game that I played just because I got it for free off of you know, PS Plus, you know, that money, you know, that I paid for it, just, you know, it's paying off in spades. Yeah. With the Simpsons arcade game, which is an old Konami beat-em-up. And it's interesting going back to this. It came out, I think, in 1990 or 1991.
It's very, very old. If you look at the characters in that game, they're like, wow, I don't even remember that guy.
Yeah, and it's interesting playing that now because it is literally a very generic beat-em-up with the characters overlaid over it and some just absolutely terrible voice samples in there, like Homer's voice samples and stuff are just awful. There's like two of them, and they're constantly reused through the entire game.
It's not that far from Bebe's Kids.
Ew, no, it's a lot better than Bebe's Kids.
I don't know, man.
That's not fair.
You remember it being better, but John
I've played it recently. It's better than Bebe's Kids. Bebe's Kids is an affront to humanity. There should be UN resolutions about Bebe's Kids.
Well, I mean, and this remake, I mean, it's done really well, you know, because they put it into the arcade game sort of border on the screen and everything, and it's really done well. But I mean, the game is so shallow, and there's characters in it. You know, you're fighting like these kind of like samurai guys, and that have nothing to do with the cartoon series whatsoever. Mm-hmm. They're just like characters that you would see in any other beat 'em up of that time period that just happened to be drawn in the style of the cartoon.
I thought like a lot of them were like minor characters from stuff that would be on posters in people's rooms or in the comic book store or stuff like that.
Not really.
The problem with The Simpsons is that it for one thing, The Simpsons was fairly new when the arcade game came out.
Yeah, at that time.
And The Simpsons isn't about fighting. So finding things like enemies and attacks and levels where it makes sense for this game to happen is very much a stretch. I mean, I think if you look at the X-Men game, which I think was Konami made that, yeah. The X-Men arcade game is very similar to The Simpsons, but I think it's more fun to play, and it just makes more sense in that universe because the X-Men are doing what the X-Men do in that game. And it's not hard for them to fill that game with Sentinels and supervillains and a boss battle against the Blob. And it just makes more sense. Whereas The Simpsons, it was a hot property. I understand why they wanted to make an arcade game about it, and I played a lot of it back then, but I don't really remember anything about it except that I put a lot of quarters in, and it was fun to play with other people. And I think when releasing a console port of these old arcade games is really dicey because there's a high probability that someone's going to download the demo for it, play it by themselves, and think, why bother? But you would never really do that in an arcade. You wouldn't walk up the Simpsons game and try to play it by yourself for any length of time.
Well, it's also impossible. It was meant to be something you can't beat single player.
Yeah, and at the time, it was new and fresh to see cartoon characters like this. Actually, you know, I mean, they look fairly good for the time period.
Oh, they look fantastic for the time period.
Yeah, so, and that was kind of one of the things where, like, you played it just to see, oh, wow, like, look at these cartoon characters that I see on TV. They're, you know, they're drawn so well, and they're put into this game. And, I mean, they pretty much throw all of the characters in there at the time, but they're just, they don't really do anything with them. They're just, like, standing in the background, or they walk by. And I find a lot of the bosses, they just wind up being characters that, you know, are sort of bad guys in the show. One of the kids, I think, that used to beat up Bart, and he just comes out and he's like huge and he starts throwing you around, and then you beat him up and he vomits or something. I don't know, whatever. But
so is that a River City Ransom reference?
kind of, I guess. I was waiting for the little barf. But yeah, and Burns is, of course, you know, he's the guy you fight at the end. And he comes out in this giant robot suit, and you have to...
Did you play through the whole game?
I played through the whole game.
Wow. Yep. That's two games you beat this week, John.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Technically, I can't take much credit. For this one, I just kept pressing A to throw in another credit.
That game is imminently beatable when quarters aren't required.
Yeah, yep. It's not like the difference, you know, say for instance if you play an arcade game like Ghost of Goblins or R-Type or something like that, you know, they had like checkpoints. So even if you could just keep shoveling in continues endlessly, you still go back to the checkpoint. You still have to overcome that particular section in one life. Whereas if you're dealing with a final fight scenario where you just you put the coin in and you go literally from that point that you were, you could brute force it without any thought whatsoever.
Well, these are multiplayer games. So, you know, if one person dies, they want the other person to be able to keep going to encourage the first person to put money in and join back in.
Exactly.
So there's not a good economic incentive for the developer to make you have to go back and replay portions of the level when it's a four-player arcade cabinet.
Right, and that's why you get the delay in there too, the 9, 8, and you go, oh.
Yeah, it's agonizing to watch that thing go down to zero. Like, you're either going to walk away, or...
Are you going to hammer the button to make it go down? Yeah. No one will continue from my start point.
Yeah, I mean, I think Backbone did a great job. I mean, they're the ones that typically do all these ports.
That's a terrible company name, by the way.
But they did a good job. You know, you can play with four players online, and they actually once you beat the game with the USA ROM, you can play the Japan ROM, which apparently has never been released over here, but it has some tweaks to it. But yeah, so I mean, it's a very good console port of it. But I just. When I was done, okay, first off, about halfway through, I said, okay, I resolved that I was going to play all the way through to the end because I knew I was never going to come back to it ever. So I said, I'm at least going to play through this game.
It's now or never.
I've seen the end boss because I'm never coming back to it.
So right now, John's playing the Japanese versions he's talking, by the way.
No. I'll read about what's different in that ROM.
You're not going to bother to read about it.
But I just thought that it was a shame that they put all this effort into a game that really wasn't that good to begin with.
It is. I mean, people have nostalgia for it, but there's no better way to ruin nostalgia than to actually give them what they think they remember, right? I mean, it seems like a good idea, and then you play it, and you're like, oh, maybe I don't like this game as much as I thought. It's probably better if you actually really like The Simpsons arcade game 20 years ago, it's better that it lives in your mind rather than in your PlayStation.
Yeah, because beat 'em ups in general have aged very poorly. Because they are such a shallow, quarter-munching style of game that it just doesn't last anymore.
Right. And if you're going to play them now, it has to be multiplayer. I mean, you're really in for a bad experience if you try to play one of these by yourself. All right, folks. Well, that's going to wrap up new business. Now we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we've got a feature discussion. What will it be?
A feature discussion.
Let's take a break while we decide. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website. Now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a review aforementioned. James Jones looks at Rhythm Heaven Fever for the Wii, and he claims in this review, "All I know about music, I learned helping a monkey tell time." Wubba dubba dubba, is that true?
Yes.
And to go along with that, we have a feature on the series, Rhythm Heaven, a musical paradise for Nintendo fans by Pedro Hernandez, in which we celebrate Nintendo's unorthodox rhythm series by a look back at its entire history.
All of it. The whole history. All three games.
All right, Neil Ronahan brings us a review of Tekken 3D Prime Edition for 3DS. He says the single player is anemic and the online multiplayer is filled with lag. Sounds like high praise to me.
Filled with it. All of the lags.
And Alex Kulafi brings us a review of Mario & Sonic at the London 2012 Olympic Games, also for 3DS. He says, I would say Mario & Sonic compete for the Olympic gold, but I'm not so sure that they even deserve a consolation prize.
Yee.
Ouch.
We have a collection of previews also this week. We have a preview for Metal Gear Solid Snake Eater 3D by Nate Andrews. And we also have a preview of Tales of the Abyss, which comes out very soon if it's not out already.
I think it just came out.
By James Dawson, a bigger Tales fan than I am.
He is, actually, he is the Tales of fan.
He is, yes. With a series that introduces itself to 3DS with what he promises is, quote, one of its greatest offerings. Editorializing in previews, James! Stop it!
That might be one of the games I pick up after Mass Effect 3.
Because you need 150-hour 3DS games, you can only play in 8-hour increments.
Yeah, I wish I had 8-hour increments to play anything, James, unlike you. This week we also have a blog called My First 3DS DLC Experience by Don Koopman. We explore Nintendo's DLC setup with packs of stickers for Japan's eShop photo booth app.
Yay. I want packs of stickers.
Let me grab my wallet.
Take my money.
There's also a feature called Wii Virtual Console Most Wanted by Andrew Brown.
It's timely.
We would still like to play. Please, Nintendo. So those have been popular segments on our podcast. You might want to read Andrew's version of it in textual form.
A lot of N64 games, i.e. a lot of stuff that will definitely not happen, but worth revisiting nonetheless.
But what if you can use the Wii U tablet as a controller pack?
Stop.
Though if they finally cracked it, the technological barrier.
Yes, and another thing I would highly recommend from last week is the last episode of Connectivity, which would probably be the two episodes ago by the time you hear this, but there is a segment about Pokemon, about why we still love Pokemon, and I was listening to it in the car in a very long, arduous drive home from skiing last weekend.
And it made it worse.
It was one of the funniest things I've ever heard. If you listen to nothing else in Connectivity, you should listen to the whole thing. But that segment, Why We Love Pokemon, is truly bizarre.
And for reference, that actually goes with the segment that was on the site a couple weeks ago.
That's right. Yes, it's a companion piece to a feature on the site. So there you go. You can check out both. Along with all of the latest news, screenshots, videos, and much more.
Thank you, Shatner.
Head over to NintendoWorldReport.com. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back from the break. It's time for our feature segment, and I joked that we were making up as we went along, but actually this has been in preparation, and we're going to do a classical RFN discussion segment on a kind of a heady topic called What is Gameplay?
So it will devolve into an argument.
And yes, I expect there will be arguments. That's kind of the point of doing these. But the genesis for this idea came from a fellow staff member and RFN listener named Minoru. He's our newest Japan correspondent. And in a staff email thread, Minoru, we sometimes get these threads where people are talking about how to best translate this or that. And he became involved in a discussion of how to translate gameplay, the word gameplay, the concept of gameplay, into Japanese. And Minoru asked Danny Bivens, another Japan correspondent on staff, He said, quote, "Do you happen to know any Japanese word equivalent to, quote, gameplay? This word is hard to grasp and even more difficult to translate." He originally settled on something with a caveat. And James, do you want to tell us what the word he settled on is?
Yeah, so it's two words sort of combined in a way that Japanese works. So it's the first word is game, which is just a Japanization of the word game, written in katakana, which is the standard way of writing foreign words. And then there's a kanji, which this pronunciation is sei, which literally means the nature of things. It's usually used as a suffix on a noun. So literally, gamusei would be saying the nature of the game.
The nature of the game. Oh, I like that. Maybe that'll come up a little later. So Minoru's explanation for this is as follows. The reason why gamusei is controversial is that it is very vague, but used frequently and considered important, just like gameplay. I hope the most intelligent gamer quartet ever, namely the RFN crew, will discuss...
That's not true.
...will discuss what gameplay is in a future episode. I remember some game review video podcast evaluates a game in three aspects, story, presentation, and gameplay. Given that story elements can be separable from gameplay... By the way, separable, amazing word to use by a non-native English speaker. That's really good. But given that story elements can be separable from gameplay, what is the gameplay element of, say, Ghost Trick? Only the puzzle solving? So I thought rather than try to define the word gameplay, which could just really devolve into semantics and kind of circular arguments that go nowhere. It's not a... I mean,
we've never done that before.
We might start slipping down that slope, but I'm going to try to pull us back out of it if it happens. I thought it'd be more interesting to focus on the concept itself rather than try to go through the dictionary defines gameplay as is. Sounds like you're starting a valedictorian speech. I'm not too interested in that. I'm more interested in how do we come at the concept. Do we think this is actually a useful concept? I mean, is it necessary to separate gameplay from story presentation, other things that you might consider when discussing a game?
You know, it's funny because the word itself probably, I mean, a lot of times when I put it into word processors, they don't regard it as a word. They just
go, it's jargon. I mean, it's a word within our world, right? Within the gaming
instinctively,
industry.
You don't really need to explain it to somebody coming from the outside because instinctively it makes sense. It is the way you play the game. But I actually ran into this a little bit when I was reviewing Rhythm Heaven. Because what I talk about for the first paragraph is, you know, I go into all the batshit crazy things you'll see in the game. I sort of write them as a rhetorical device of discussing, you know, my thoughts on the game as I'm playing it, and then put at the end, you know, this is the kind of things you're going to think about while you're playing this game. But what I do is I step back and say, but really, the game is sort of insidious in that its simplistic gameplay is really what the core of it is, and everything else is sort of layered on top of it.
I think some of those issues with Rhythm Heaven, where gameplay is being, you know, enhanced, perhaps in a sort of illusory way at times, by audiovisual elements and whatnot, that is where separating gameplay out from story and visuals and audio is not as clean as it might appear at first.
And that's sort of the exercise I was trying to go on with that.
And I think some people could even make the argument that Rhythm Heaven doesn't have any gameplay. And
well, they'd be wrong.
Well, I have a quote from Sid Meier, who his personal definition of gameplay is a series of interesting choices. And Rhythm Heaven not only doesn't have any interesting choices, it doesn't have any choices. I mean, the only choice is whether you play the game or not, but...
See, now, where I come at, for me, gameplay is bound up in the concept of agency. And the decision-making, you know, is a big part of agency, but it's not everything. In terms of it, I would think of it as your ability to act, the capacity of you as a player to act within the confines of the game.
That sounds fair.
To do what's needed.
Decisions are one kind of action, and some games feature that a lot. You know, strategy games or, you know, a Heavy Rain, choose-your-own-adventure kind of game, visual novels. You know, there's all sorts of decisions that could be made in games of various types, but...
Yeah, I mean, to me, the cornerstone is interactivity. There's interactivity between the player and the game in some way.
So not Heavy Rain, then.
Well, I mean, there is interaction in Heavy Rain, obviously, in terms of the quick time events, but I would argue that even just, you know, where it comes down to a straight sort of choice that you're making, that is still gameplay to me.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's layers, there's tiers of interactivity.
There's tears
watching
of joy.
Watching a movie is not gameplay.
So Metal Gear Solid 4 then.
Okay, but what about dancing? What about knitting? Let's say you have a pattern to knit and you mm-hmm. follow that pattern and you produce something at the end. How is that different than DDR? DDR gives you a pattern, you fulfill the pattern.
To me, gameplay is interacting with the game towards an objective.
With a game. That's what separates knitting, because knitting isn't the game.
I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit, but my point is...
Don't make me start driving out the devil here, because I will.
My point is, it is so certainly... I mean, I think Greg made a very good argument for the idea that games don't actually have to have choices in order to have gameplay.
No, I mean, it's still your actions, isn't it? You know, I mean, at the end of the day, DDR, that's your actions there. Now, it's very binary. You either do it right or you do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And some people don't like that kind of game and they can't get into it. Some people love it.
I would argue that Sid Meier's apparently likes no types of gameplay since he hasn't made one since 2006. But it's funny that he mentions Ghost Trick, because I had a similar problem when I was reviewing that game as well. So apparently I get all the games where it's hard to make the clean fission between the two. But in that game, really, the gameplay itself, like he sort of implies, isn't very much fun without what's built on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
However, what's built on top of it is so driven by what the game mechanic is. I mean, it feels like everything sort of wraps back around itself. Where in that
right.
game, I could very clearly say what I believe the gameplay to be is, and that's essentially moving from place to place and interacting with stuff to get from one part of the screen to another.
Mm-hmm.
It's a puzzle-solving game, effectively. I mean, if it were by itself, if there was nothing built on top of that, it was literally you just moving a dot from one item to the next so you get there, that would be a DSiWare game that no one would buy.
I'd say Ghost Trick is a great example of a game where the gameplay is maybe the least important part of the game. It was certainly essential that there is gameplay, that it is interactive, that there's something for the player to do other than just push a button to advance text. That's not really a game, right?
Well, hold on, wait. What about visual novels then?
Well, in those games, you're choosing your own adventure, aren't you?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, that's.
I mean, I think some people would argue that visual novels really aren't video games. They're presented through the format of video games, but they're not really meant to be played in that sense. But I guess they are at least interactive in the sense.
They're a damn sight closer than knitting.
I was thinking of things with patterns that you fill out. Sorry if I threw you off with that argument. But anyway, the thing about Ghost Trick is that the gameplay itself is sort of a means to an end. And what's interesting about it is that the gameplay, though, when you're playing the game, it doesn't feel like a chore, and it doesn't feel trivial to do the mechanics of the game, to move around and to activate the different objects and to make things happen, because the story and the presentation lend a gravity to your actions. Even though your actions are very simple, they're not difficult to figure out, they really aren't all that interesting on their own, but you're changing history. You're altering the flow of time. You're saving people's lives. You're bringing the dead back to life by drawing your lines and moving your dot around on the screen. And so that's a case where the gameplay itself isn't the reason to play Ghost Trick. It's the method through which you experience Ghost Trick.
It's the context issue, I think, is very important, because this is where you get this kind of enhancement, how you can accentuate the sort of positive sensations of just fulfilling an objective in a game, because you tie it in to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it creates an illusion of your actions, you know, the gameplay that you've engaged in, being kind of more important and more meaningful than they really are. That, to me, is where some of the greatest things in games could come from, is where it is actually, you know, a bit of sleight of hand. You know, I mean, we've talked about the ending to Super Metroid before, a you know, very celebrated gaming moment. How much of that is your agency? You know, how much are you really determining of that fight? You know, a lot of it's actually scripted, but you don't know that the first time you're doing it.
Right.
And so it has this powerful illusion of your actions being meaningful and you're participating in this event, but on the other hand, it has all the drama of it being scripted.
Right.
Because there's no obvious separation between cutscene and gameplay in that game, in Super Metroid, you know. So I think those are some of the greatest moments that games can have, where the gameplay itself, your actual actions and how they affect the game world, are wrapped up and bundled up into something else, something bigger, a lovely little illusion that ultimately, you know, upon repeat plagues or whatever, or even perhaps to some extent at the time, you'll be able to see through. But it's just a lovely effect, and it's emotional ultimately. It actually draws more out of you because you think your actions are what's creating this result.
Yeah, and I think we crave illusions a lot of the time. I mean, you think about someone who goes to a magic show, they know the stuff they're going to see is not real, but they
or
want,
is it?
But they want to be, they want the sensation of, even if it's for a brief moment, believing that it could be real before your logic kicks back in, right?
Or trying to figure it out.
So you want to have the suspension of disbelief because it's pleasurable. And I think video games are great for that. It's a really good point.
That's where, like I say, when you're trying to separate these things, it gets more problematic than what I think. Well, you know, it's easy to separate the game versus, well, anything where your actions, whether they be decisions, whether they be controlling a character, whether they be assembling a strategy, you know, in a Fire Emblem type game or this, that, or the other, anything that's to do with what you do and how that translates into the game, we can cordon that off and that's fine. But the fact is that a lot of how effective that is about how it's presented,
right,
is about the context. And so at that point, you have to look at the whole package.
I would say that it's not quite as easy sometimes, even that. I mean, you get games where, actually, Ogre Battle is a pretty good example. I would spend a lot of time just sitting there going through menus looking at items. Am I really playing anything at that point?
I think you're still working towards an objective.
Ogre Battle, I would say the majority of the gameplay in Ogre Battle, even from what I played of it, which is obviously significantly less than that of James, so you see what you think of this, is in the preparation. In all those decisions that you make about what component units to put together to make a larger unit and how to equip them, and mm-hmm. you know, how you're going to approach the upcoming battle and what kind of strategy you're going to deploy, all the decisions, all the actions that are really crucial to how it's going to play out are taken early.
You're stacking up the dominoes, and then the rest of the game is watching to see if they fall the way you thought they would fall.
I mean, how I usually play that game, and it's less so now because I sort of took the wonderment out of it as I peeled back the curtain through repeated playthroughs.
Yeah.
But a lot of how I played that game, especially the first few times, was I basically played the whole thing in my head. I didn't need to touch the controller during that time. I probably did. I probably just leafed through menus and looked at stuff while I was doing all the arithmetic in my mind. But it was that gameplay at that moment, if I don't have to do anything, if the game could be off and I'm sitting in another room just putting things together in my mind, am I playing the game at that point?
Well, I firmly believe that, you know, while it may not be action, the preparation part, you know, making all those decisions and projecting it all out in your head, those are things that you're doing that ultimately determine whether or not you're going to win that battle, or indeed how you're going to win it to some extent in a game like Ogre Battle. I mean, it's not as binary as DDR or Rhythm Heaven. You know, you can win it in a bunch of different ways, in different styles, or with different levels of loss on your own side and all this kind of stuff. As with RPGs, I mean, it really gets to, you know, you go from, you know, the binary nature of a rhythm game or a classic arcade game to this humongous range of outcomes and permutations that all ultimately come back to the decisions and the actions that you took. And that's what I think is so fascinating about the gameplay in those types of games, is that it's really seeing how it translates. You know, in some games it's all about, well, when I do this, this must happen.
Right.
And if it doesn't, it's bad gameplay. You know, when it's about controls, it's about responsiveness.
If I turn right, it should go right.
Exactly, certain expectations there. But with RPGs and strategy games, a lot of the joy of it is just seeing how your decisions actually play out, whether they play out as you imagined them, or maybe if they play out in ways you hadn't imagined that are amusing because they're so different. These are the sorts of radically different kind of gameplay. It's not action and all, but it is gameplay nonetheless.
I actually sort of equate it to back when I was trying to learn to play Go. which, if you're not familiar, is a board game of Chinese origin where you it's two-player. There's a series of black stones and white stones, and you basically are trying to mark out territory on a grid. But a lot of the game is spent sort of trying to put yourself in this advantageous position, but you're playing it in your head. Really, the only action you're doing is the amount of time it takes between picking up a stone with two fingers from a dish and putting it down on the board.
Yeah, I think internalized gameplay is a totally legitimate thing.
It's kind of weird in the confines of a game, though, because in this case, like an Ogre Battle, literally I'm playing the game in a different location entirely from the game itself. I'm playing the game while it's off.
Well, I think the fact that you can play Tetris in your head, whether you want to or not, is one of the defining aspects of that game. And I think it... I don't know that that's the reason I like Tetris, but I think it's more a consequence of just how good it is, just how primal Tetris is and how it works on your spatial reasoning and your ability to solve these problems in a very short period of time and the stress that that induces and the heightened level of awareness that that stress causes. And I think all of that is very much a quality of that game and of the gameplay. And I think the fact that you can't stop playing it even after you turn the system off, even after you shut your eyes and lie down in your bed at night, is a wonderful thing. I think it says so much about the quality of that game and just how effective it is. So to me, Ogre Battle is a little more intentional on your part in terms of playing it in your head.
Right.
But it's a similar thing. I think it's just as valid. And the thing about Tetris is you can continue to sort of play Tetris for probably a couple days after you stop playing it, and you might never go back to it. But with Ogre Battle, the things that you're doing offline, you're going to take back to that game and use those as inputs and put it back into the game systems and get a new result that you can then go take off and do again. So
I do kind of – I'm a bit concerned that right now we're trying to define with examples as opposed to tackling the meat of the issue.
Well, it is one of those amorphous concepts, right? I think examples are a good way because they're illuminating, you know, especially if they're examples that people are familiar with. They give you a place to look from, and it's one of those things that maybe you can only see gameplay by examining the shadows that it casts. So let me change the angle here. A couple years ago at PAX East for our first panel, we had a topic about what makes a Nintendo game a Nintendo game, or what qualities do Nintendo games have in common, what makes other people's games feel like Nintendo games even when they're not. And I think a lot of us sort of refer to some kind of intrinsic quality of gameplay. And so I wanted to kind of bring it back to that a little bit and say, do we feel, as Nintendo fans, obviously, do we feel that Nintendo's games have better gameplay than most other games? And if so, in what way? I mean, how do we not quantify that, but how do we qualify that? I mean, what about these games makes us feel like they play better?
Well, of course, it's wildly different according to the different kinds of games that Nintendo makes, which, you know, they do certainly make a lot of different styles of games, and they publish, obviously, you know, something broader again. And then you get into, well, how much of the Nintendo influence even extends, you know, beyond games that they actually make themselves. But for me, I mean, first of all, they definitely tend to emphasize gameplay more than a lot of their rivals.
Is that by omission? Is that by omission? Omitting certain elements of presentations and story that other developers focus more on?
To some extent, that is true in the sense that you are not going to have, you know, as much of the, I mean, you know, from a very simple way of looking at it, but the less relevant, there is a certain budget for a game to be made. And, you know, that is a scarce resource to be managed. And Nintendo are not in the habit of spending a lot of that on things like voice acting or CG cutscenes.
But even then, Greg, I mean, if you set the resource availability aside, could it be intentional? Could they avoid putting emphasis on those elements of the game because they are not gameplay, because they want the gameplay itself to stand out more?
I think they purposely do that, absolutely.
Obviously, they could afford to put voice acting in Zelda. they don't want to.
I believe that very much. I mean, I've just said that is one way which you can quantify the extent to which they emphasize gameplay relative terms more than other publishers, is that you could quite easily say they just do not spend as much of their development budgets on stuff that is quite separate, although we, again, you can't necessarily separate it altogether, but you know, they are emphasized on those things. Now, in terms of why, you know, I would say generally, you know, Nintendo games are amongst the most playable that you will ever find in the industry. And as to why that is the case, I think, first of all, in the area of action games, they're always very, very careful about getting controls right, you know, some of the basics. I mean, in terms of, you know, for me, what makes a game satisfying to play, and therefore, you know, we would say the gameplay is good, is that your actions translated into the game, they feel right.
It's an immediacy, right?
Yeah, with action games, you have to be sort of immediate and make a sort of intuitive sense. You know, even though it's a acid trip Mario world platformer, all this kind of stuff, the inertia that they put into Mario's movement going all the way back to Super Mario Brothers makes sense on an intuitive level to players, which is why it is so much fun to play, in that they see their actions translate into Mario's movement in a way that's intrinsically satisfying because of that mechanic that they put in there. And so they're always very careful about that sort of thing, that your inputs, they respond quickly, and then the actual mechanics themselves make some sort of intuitive sense. And then I think the other part of it, of course, is level design and all enemy design and all this kind of aspects of game design that can actually take advantage of these different core mechanics in such a way that people feel like they're applying their skills that they're developing in new and interesting ways that escalate and a feeling of progression until ultimately you beat the game.
That's the crack for me personally.
I think Nintendo generally are very good at learning curves and difficulty curves. You know, I mean, some would say perhaps they've gone a bit too towards the hand-holdy aspects in recent times, or certain kinds of games nowadays, you know, maybe Zelda, they take too long with tutorials or this, that, and the other. And I certainly for veterans of the series, you know, there's probably some validity in that. But I think broadly over the company's history, they're so very good at just bringing you along at a pace that just feels, again, on some intuitive level, it feels right, and you feel yourself growing in skill and ability as the game grows in complexity, and there's sort of harmony there. And that's one of the aspects of they're very consistent over their library that other publishers just can't really compare.
I'm glad you got to elucidate there, since you weren't on the panel a couple years ago. That was really good. So, to me, a really key part of video games in particular is the feedback that you get.
Yeah.
They give you an action, they train you to do it, there's some kind of feedback mechanism, and you say, okay, well, I could do that better, or wow, I did that really well, and now I'm rewarded, and I get to do something else. And I think Nintendo is often among the best. There are a lot of companies that do this well, but I think Nintendo is among the best at giving you a feedback that is not explicit. They don't necessarily say, great job, you did 100%. Instead, what they'll do is they'll reward you with a secret place that you know that's very clear that other people would not find this because they didn't do that thing that you just did as well as you did. So, you know, I think that's fun. Also, a lot of times it's just, did you use your noggin to try something that other people might not have? So that's one thing I love about, let's say, Wario Land 2 is a great example. I'm sorry, it's a bit obscure, but Metroid is maybe a less obscure example. But these are games in which a huge percentage of the game is completely optional, even from the sense of if you just want to beat the game. There's lots of secret places all over the place, and they're not necessarily hard to get to. They don't require that much skill. What they require is thoughtfulness to get to. So you have to think, maybe there's something over there, and maybe they left a hint, and it's up to you to be observant and to capture that. And again, it's one of those cases where what happens in the game is maybe not all that dramatic. In some cases, you just walk left when the game is clearly expecting you to go right. And when you do that, when you defy the expectation, you do the thing that's not intuitive, or you do the thing that's not easy, then you go over there and you find something that is, look, in the real world is totally meaningless, but it's an indication, it's an acknowledgement of your cleverness. And
well, that's exactly it. And that's why I always complain about when games have little nooks and crannies in areas of the world, but there's nothing there. So you can go in there and you can find something and you can dig out this little alleyway or something and there's just nothing there. I mean,
that is irritating.
It's kind of a moment, I think, where you get to connect with the game designers in an indirect way. Of like, they've just say, well, not that many people would have probably come along here based on our testing. So if anybody does, we'll just put a little thing in there as a little, you know, tip of the hat. Nice one on getting here and something, yeah, that might be even in the confines of the game, utterly trivial. But it's the sort of thing that can satisfy because there is that acknowledgement there. And I think the point is with gameplay, when you get these worlds or these games, what you want to feel like is that your actions matter. And I think some of why you might think your actions matter, you know, it could be a story. It could be because, well, this narrative's going on and these characters have this conflict or whatever. But the other thing, I think, is just that if a world feels like it's got some substance to it, as if it's actually got things that almost go beyond the ruthless objective of just finishing the game, and that it feels fully developed and, you know, even if it's very fantastical, kind of real in a way. And therefore, the nature of the world you're inhabiting puts a different context on the sort of actions you're performing. So if you just have something that says to you, the people that made this game put a lot of thought into it, and if I put thought into it, we're going to connect here, and then that makes all the things that you do, all that gameplay, more meaningful in a way because you're more connected to it.
Absolutely. My favorite people to play games with are the game designers who made the games. So you expressed it beautifully, Greg. I mean, one of my very favorite things about playing video games is that almost psychic connection you feel, that kindredness with the people who made the game. When you see that you begin to understand the game the same way that they understand the game, and that you're playing it the way they hoped you would play it. Because, you know, they developed this for years and they turn it out to the world, and there's no telling what people do with it in a lot of cases. Mm. And the sensation, you get this very often in Nintendo games, that you have played the game in a sort of nuanced, special way, and maybe in an expert way. And the developers meet you. It's almost like they come out of the shadows and they said, "We always hoped you'd make it this far. You know, you've done well,
my
kid.
Son."
And here's your prize, you know, and that is a magical moment. And the more you can pull that off, and the more different ways you can pull that off in a given game, probably the more I'll like it. And it's one of those things that, like, I don't want to be a game designer because I don't know how to pull that off. Like, I'm scared. That's a lot of pressure to get inside the heads of the people who are going to play your game and figure out all the things that they're going to try to do. And then you try to do it first so that you can be there when they arrive. That is really terrifying. And when I play a game that does it consistently over and over, those tend to be my favorite games.
And on the flip side of where we might look at gameplay, even sort of unorthodox kind of gameplay, maybe that some people might not even consider gameplay, could sort of fall down. James mentioned this with L.A. Noire, just in passing, the idea that basically it seems like after a few times that it doesn't really matter what you did in the interview.
No, it's irrelevant.
It's going to play out the same way because your partner just said, "Oh, well, I thought of this."
Well, to be fair, the journey, the way that it plays out as events proceed will be different. That does depend on what you're doing. The final outcome, ultimately, you will move on to the next case either way.
The actual objective. And in the end, it'll happen and the chief will still come and congratulate you and not your partner.
Yeah, so you're sort of on rails.
That is a case where ultimately it's the limits to that kind of illusion that we talked about. At some point, it's like, well, I am just making these bunch of choices, but they can only affect it so much. And once you start to see the kind of barriers that it runs up against, like, ultimately it kind of makes how you decide on some of these things probably less compelling, less involving.
Oh, definitely.
You start to see the strings and maybe it all looks a bit rickety and not so fascinating anymore. And so that's the problem with some of these story-based games. I mean, they're really trying to sustain some very elaborate illusions, because of course, if you were going to have like really wide-ranging choices of consequences in it's something that's also trying to be super cinematic, you know, that's very difficult to construct. It creates a lot of problems. And of course, some games, you know, do an admirable job of it. But perhaps the toughest thing, or perhaps also the most important thing to do, is just to paper over those cracks elegantly in such a way that you don't have that moment that James talked about where it's kind of like, oh, yeah, realization of that, where it just makes you less involved. And I mean, that to me is a case of where the gameplay is kind of falling down, but also because of things that aren't necessarily strictly about gameplay, like the dialogue or, you know, the direction of the scenes.
If I were reviewing L.A. Noire, I would hit it for this, because I really feel like it, now that I know effectively I'm always going to get the perp, or, well, insofar as the game takes it.
Mm-hmm.
The right guy is going to go to jail. I'm not going to put an innocent behind bars because I asked the wrong questions.
Yeah, there might be bad guys who you don't catch if you do things poorly, but you'll get the main one.
Yeah, and in fact, in one case, I never really went back to the station to interview this guy, but another character just sort of said it in passing, and you might not even make the connection that I read this guy's address book and it was a young child in it. That he preys on children. But they're like, oh, and good job catching that child molester. I'm like, I didn't even interview him.
Yeah, that's really... I've had stuff like that happen to me in the game. And it's one of those cases where it's not that it makes you step back and say, oh, I'm playing a game. You know you're playing a game. What it makes you step back and say is, oh, what I do doesn't really matter. And that sucks.
Yeah, why did you deprive me of being able to figure that out?
Right, that's when you feel like the game is sort of force feeding you certain things and it doesn't really care what you do. And that's, as the person playing the game, that's not a good feeling.
I think the core thing of that, though, in terms of where you can apply, you know, that as a kind of failing of gameplay to other genres that are quite different, you know, and with the way in which you interact with them is quite different. Ultimately, your agency, your action are not terribly consequential.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where in other kinds of games you could say, if you find that what you're doing isn't terribly consequential, it takes a lot out of the experience. You know, it's one of the reasons why people are not very fond of Wii Music.
Yeah. Oh, that's huge.
They feel that their component in that experience is kind of trivial, and they don't really like it. And, you know, I mean, I can't imagine things being much more different than Wii Music and L.A. Noire, but I see it as fundamentally the same gameplay drawback there. And so I think that's a big part of that. Just that, you know, within the confines of this game, whatever it is.
Just Dance, by the way. I mean, have you guys ever seen the videos of like dogs playing Just Dance?
Yes.
Where, you know, they just kind of stick a remote in its mouth and it gets 90%. Or whatever.
It was like, Boogie, wasn't it? But it was Boogie with the baby.
Boogie. Oh, yeah. That was huge.
The, what was it? The Kinect dance game. The first one.
Dance Central?
Dance Central. Yeah. I remember I was standing at E3 2010, and the discussion that I was having was, is this just a random point generator? I watched the same song get played two times, and one person was clearly not as good as the other, and it looked like they got the same score. I'm like, what?
That's also where you wonder, are they doing some scaling or something? And one thing that annoys me a lot in video games is where they try to scale it so that everyone has sort of the same kind of outcome. So they try to hide how good you are at it as you play it. So in other words, they're obscuring the feedback in order to remain positive across the board. And to me, that's no feedback at all. And so those games are very unsatisfying to play because it doesn't really seem to matter what I do here. I mean, the action that I'm doing might be intrinsically fun, you know, like Just Dance. People like Just Dance because they like dancing, not because it's a good game. The game itself is almost not there because...
Well, they like dancing and they like the music, really.
Yeah, they like the music or they just... It's a good excuse to get up and dance, but you don't need the video game to do that.
It's a pretense, and it's effective in that sense, but in terms of the gameplay component of it, in terms of actually, you know, your actions and how that sort of translates, that almost seems to be a little bit incidental. You know, I mean, for me, it's a very important part that you have a sort of palpable connection to the game, you know, that your impact is being felt by the game.
Right.
You know, Rhythm Heaven, you know, to go back to that, does a really good job just just in the way that the sort of bizarre off-color noises that it makes when you get stuff wrong. You know, it's just this, it sort of really drills it into your head that you're doing something. It's like, ugh, you know, you want it to sound right. And then when it does sound right, it's such a reinforcement mechanism.
Yeah.
And that is a lot of, you know, what's very important. I mean, ultimately, you can have great gameplay mechanics and you could have all sorts of nice controls and all that make that possible. But in the end, there is something very basic that has to happen as well of just, you know, the Zelda chime. It's not just that you found something in that chest, it's that it played a cool little tune as you did it that really accentuates the sensation. And that, you know, I mean, that's again something I think Nintendo's really good at. And that's also, I think, where they tend to focus their audiovisual attention is on accentuating essential gameplay elements rather than stuff that's a bit more separate, you know, with some exceptions like Other M being taken.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about Super Mario Brothers and, like, how much less fun would that game be if it didn't make a sound when you jumped? Because the feel of jumping, I mean, in terms of, you know, the inertia, the height that you reach, the amount of control that you have when you're still in the air, all of that is incredibly important to how you play that game and how much fun it is to play. But without that Pavlovian response of it making the boing, you know, every time you do it, that's a very pleasurable sound to hear. It's very fun.
And you take it with you when you leave the game as well.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, when something happens, I mean, you can hear the, you know, the coin sound when you grab the coin. Bling, bling.
And it's different than music because the music's going to play regardless of what you do.
You can stand and, there.
It's about reinforcing that connection between what you're doing and the game world.
Right.
Yeah, that's where Nintendo have had it cracked from a very early stage in the game industry's life, that you really need to do that kind of thing. That, you know, as important as the core elements of gameplay are, you have to embed it in this game world that it might be, you know, really simple, but the important thing is that you feel connected to it.
Right. Now, we haven't talked about multiplayer yet, and, you know, I was thinking earlier about something like Smash Brothers.
It's gameplay times two. There we go. Next question.
To me, Smash Brothers kind of goes back to what James was saying about Ogre Battle, where in Ogre Battle, you play a lot of the game offline in your head. And I feel like with Smash Brothers, the game is sort of designed, the gameplay is designed offline in a sense. Because to me,
in a literal sense, too. Well,
to me, the gameplay in Smash Brothers doesn't exist until they turn it out on the world and unleash it to the players. And then we create the gameplay ourselves among each other. And so it has to be a very theoretical process when they're creating these games. Really any multiplayer game, but I'll use Smash Brothers because I'm more familiar with it than a lot of other ones. But for the people making Smash Brothers, they're creating all these elements that can be mixed in a million different ways. And their goal is to make elements that have enough depth, that can be used in multiple ways, that can combine with a lot of other things to create unique interactions. They're creating sort of a space that can be filled by formulas, and the formulas are populated by these variables, which are 35 characters and 100 different items and Pokemon and assist trophies and 50 different levels. And all this crazy stuff can happen. If you take any three of those things and put them together, something totally different happens. But that alone is not the gameplay. The gameplay is then, what do the players do with it? And it's a game where, you know, the stuff that I was describing before and Greg about how in a game with level design where you're exploring something or you're interacting with the stuff that's already there in the game and you're trying to prod the edges of it to find something special, that is totally different than the gameplay in a multiplayer experience like Smash Brothers, where the amazing things that I remember, I mean, I think back to all my experiences with Smash Brothers over the past decade, and the things that I remember are more what happens outside the TV screen. It's the things that we say to each other. It's laughing at each other and what we've done in the game, and not so much the individual elements. And yet I think these games have amazing gameplay, but the gameplay is created by us. by our interactions. And the game design is mainly an exercise in inducing those things, in creating an atmosphere in which those things can blossom.
I think you're getting a little too ethereal here. I mean, I would say the gameplay is still what's going on inside. I would say it's the feedback that's taking place outside. Hmm. I don't think the sound of Mario jumping is gameplay. That's feedback on the gameplay.
No, but it accentuates it.
Right. I would say what's going on outside the screen is feedback on the gameplay inside the game.
But at the same time, what happens is you get a sort of feedback loop.
Right.
In that it starts to affect your actions. It affects the way you play the game.
Oh,
probably for the worse, but yes.
And I think sometimes they're very directly trying to play into that. I mean, I think of like the WarioWare GameCube game, which is all about taking the GBA one and doing multiplayer with it, turning it into a party game. You just get stuff that's hardly interacting with the game itself at all, because the game has no way of verifying you're doing it, like doing stupid noises or like tapping your head and rubbing your belly or something. I can't remember.
Oh, the Wii game is the same thing.
Yeah, the Wii game with like positioning the
put it remote on your nose. No.
Yeah, like a trunk or all this kind of stuff. I mean, that what it's playing to there is the fact that it knows that you're playing it with another person and they're going to kind of enforce it and you're going to find it embarrassing doing it in front of this person or multiple
that
people.
That is weird, isn't it? And Wii Party does the same thing where it tells you to hide the remote. Well, the game doesn't know if you hit it or not. They're counting on social pressure. So this is a really interesting case where the game is providing rules that it alone cannot enforce, but it's still setting up a rule set and it's counting on the humans to enforce it for it. Really interesting thing that's from a single player game, it's very hard for the designers to provide rules and just ask you politely to voluntarily conform to them.
Right. At that point, it's more of like a board game, that the software itself is just the board.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying the Monopoly board has no gameplay. It's mm-hmm. when you start executing on the board that it does.
I would say the gameplay is in the instruction manual that comes with Monopoly.
Or whatever crazy-ass rules people have invented for their own flavor
right.
of Monopoly.
Yeah, you put all the tax money on free parking.
Well, to me, I think that is, it only really becomes a game with other people.
Yes.
Because then actually what's happening, if gameplay is all about your actions, and then we have a game here where the only context in which it makes sense is it's the fact that you are having interaction with other people, then essentially there is no gameplay unless you're with other people. So, I mean, that's what party games are. You know, I mean, that's why, you know, it isn't any fun to play Mario Party by yourself. Because again, in terms of are your actions consequential? The whole game is designed with the idea that they will be given meaning by the other people being there.
By alcohol.
Yeah,
exactly.
Certain, enhancements.
A wild card rule added to the game.
One thing, though, is that I would say that in the case of Mario Party, there is real core gameplay in the game.
You've got mini games in that. I mean,
your ultimate objective is to have the most stars at the end. So your actions are designed.
Oh, sure. I mean, Mario Party, let's say it ceases to be a game altogether. That case, it really just is. It's very much diminished.
It's not optimized for single player. It still has gameplay, but it's not optimized for that.
One way that I find that Mario Party to actually be kind of entertaining is to play it no player. Is to pick all four of them computer-controlled characters and just let them randomly select skill levels.
Now that's a drinking game.
Because what you'll find is that, like, the game will almost deliberately cheat to get one character. Because when you're playing by yourself or with a couple people, the AI will deliberately benefit one character. And you don't see it because there's other people going on, but when you just watch the game play itself, you can see that it seems like almost every time Toad is winning every minigame.
So you're saying always pick Toad.
Well, no, it'll move around, but you'll be able to identify there is one character who is winning everything.
Yeah.
In that way, it almost becomes more fun, because if you got people around, you'll start picking characters to cheer for, and you'll be like, damn it, Peach, what is your problem today?
So it's horse racing at that point.
It is, except it's rigged horse racing. It's beautiful.
So it's horse racing.
That kind of thing, you know, where you see the computer rig things, you know, is another element again where, you know, sort of like the LA Noir thing where it can break the illusion. Of course, people often complain about rubber banding in racing games, you know, particularly Mario Kart, of course, you know, where I think this was a big complaint, the N64 one. that you could race absolutely brilliantly, and even without items coming into play, the guy in second would still be, you know, right up your ass.
He'd go faster than his car can possibly go.
Yeah, exactly. The fact that the game is not playing by its own rules, it does diminish how meaningful your interactions are with that game, and it is a knock against the game's gameplay. I
would say, like, F-Zero GX, the story mode, where like you would see the AI in the cars do things they just can't do under human control.
Mm-hmm.
Like take turns at speeds that there's no way that thing could take that turn.
Right. Very frustrating. I mean, I quit story mode. I never finished it because of that. So let's wrap it up with this question. This was kind of my idea for closing thoughts on this feature. What games do we personally feel have the best gameplay? So that kind of, you know, implies that we have some method of evaluating it, at least on a personal level. And are those games, the ones that we think have the best gameplay, are those also our favorite games?
Yeah, broadly speaking, yes. I mean, in terms of what games have the best gameplay, the problem is, in some cases, the actual kinds of interactions that you're having in different genres are so different that you're getting into apples and oranges. They're incommensurable. But yeah, broadly speaking, I would say yes. You know, a lot of the games that are my favorite ever, you know, if we're talking about something like Super Mario 3 or A Link to the Past, primarily what make those games absolutely brilliant is the quality of their gameplay.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, in terms of just pure technical gameplay, Tetris would definitely be up there because it has...
If you did send that memo, I was going to end this call.
No, I mean, because it has a rule set that doesn't change, but when you play it, it's different every single time.
When they did change the rules, by the way, people flipped their shit.
As well they should.
Yes.
Because there's no need to change the rules of Tetris.
John Lindemann hates change. For me, I can't think of a straight-up example of the games that I think have the best gameplay, because it's still a bit amorphous for me, and it's what you're attempting to do.
Well, I mean, I suppose the flip side would be, is there a game that you would count among the favourite ever where the gameplay component is not necessarily all that important to how excellent it is?
You know, actually, yeah, 999 is a pretty good example of that.
Ah.
Yes, you do influence the outcome of the game by what clues you find throughout it and with some decisions you make, but a lot of the game is just it telling you a story.
Because, mm-hmm. You could make an argument for the gameplay such as it is being really crucial in 999 if a huge part of what you got out of it is seeing how your decisions translated into different endings or...
And you do.
But you're saying, in a large part, it's just the quality of the story that's being told.
Right. I mean, ultimately, the outcome is, did you click that safe a couple times versus one time? It's like, well, yeah, I only clicked it once. Well, you're...
See, if it's got a kind of arbitrary quality to it, that goes again to the fact it doesn't have that connection, that kind of palpable connection that is really satisfying. If it's just kind of like, well, I might have done that, I might have not, you know, it doesn't really matter, but it's is what's come out of it.
Because the game wants you to play it multiple times to try the different paths. And really, it's the collective of... when you've played the different paths and put it all together and realize what every character is to every other character because of all the relationships that aren't explicitly said through any one play, is that when the game actually starts to work on you. It's not the actual act of playing, because you may play the same room all four times. And after the first time, you're just going, click, 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 okay, I'm done. But it's the net gain you get from it, the experience afterwards on top of the gameplay, that makes that really work on you.
Well, I wrote this question, and then I started to think about what would my answer be, and the outcome surprised me, because I feel like on this podcast, I'm usually a champion for game design and gameplay over other attributes that we find in video games. You know, and I think some of the all-time best gameplay of games is stuff like Metroid Zero Mission. I think A Link to the Past is a very good example. I'd say Portal and Portal 2.
Absolutely.
Just to name a few. But those games are not necessarily my favorite of all time. And usually when I tell people, you know, people ask me what are my favorite games ever, I will usually say Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy IV and Final Fantasy VI. And they're all very similar, obviously, to each other. And I don't really think the gameplay is necessarily anything special. I mean, they all have gameplay. I think what they do well. but I don't think they do anything particularly interesting with the gameplay. I don't think any of them are terribly strategic, except maybe the DS version of FF4. I don't think you make a lot of interesting choices in any of these games. Chrono Trigger maybe the most in terms of which side quests you do, but it's never really a choice for me because I always did all of them because I wanted to, I just wanted to do all of them. So it's not necessarily leaving anything on the table. I never felt a whole lot of consequence going the other way. And so I came to this sort of surprising realization that in the moment when I'm playing games, I appreciate the gameplay most of all. And usually on the podcast, for instance, when I'm talking about games, they're games I played very recently. You know, it's whatever I played that week. And so I will tend to heap a lot of praise on gameplay or games that focus on that because it's the immediacy. It's the, you know, that leaves me with the freshest feeling and the most excitement. But I think the games that stick with me the longest and that are the most formative for me and the games that I probably have spent the most time thinking about and remembering and admiring long, long, long after I played them are the ones with very affecting stories and really charming, really beautiful presentation. And I think that applies to all three of my favorite games of all time. And I think the music is huge in tying those to certain memories. And I think the characters that develop, even though they're very simple and they're archetypal and, you know, in some cases even stereotypical, I think those characters, because they're very long games, you spend a long time with them, you develop certain relationships and you fill in, especially because I was young when I played all three of these games. And so as a young person, I had more time to fill in the backstory, to imagine what these characters were like in between the events that happen in the games themselves. And so those aspects of the games, I think, ultimately leave a bigger impression on me, even though in the moment, I'll appreciate the gameplay the most. And so it's a case where I think about all the Zelda games, and I love the puzzles and the level designs and the exploration and all that stuff that you do in Zelda games, but I don't know that any Zelda game would crack my top five, even though I love playing them in the moment, because they don't really have much of a story, and the presentation is usually utilitarian outside of maybe Wind Waker.
I would, except maybe Majora's Mask as well, with the moon.
Yes, and Majora's Mask is my favorite Zelda game, and the moon is a big part of it, because it leaves this incredible impression on you. You know, you can never forget it once you see that. And that moon has little to do with gameplay. It's an artistic element of the game.
But, I mean, what's interesting about Majora's Mask is in terms of the constraints that it puts on you, namely the time limit.
Right.
Which results in you taking different priorities and acting in a Zelda game in a way different from the way you've acted in every other Zelda game you've ever played is intrinsically tied to that moon. I mean, again, it's the elegance of the narrative conceit, I think, matters in terms of how much that constraint then drives your decision-making and the way you play the game in general. So there again, I think you see that it's not as easy to separate these things as it first appears, that there is, and in fact, when gaming is at its best, it's blurring the lines.
I agree. That's a great point. To me, the best games do, the really impressive, to me, the games that really push the art form of video games in new and better directions are the ones where it's really kind of hard to distinguish gameplay from story and presentation. And once when they're really all working together and it feel, you know, Ghost Trick is, James and I talked about it as our favorite game last year, and that's a big part of it, because to me, it's a really stupid exercise to try to pick apart the gameplay from everything else in that game, because it almost doesn't exist on its own, nor should it. That's not the point. And yet, if you took the gameplay totally out and just made that game non-interactive, it wouldn't be nearly as good. It wouldn't be nearly as satisfying. So the gameplay is important, and yet on its own, it's really nothing special at all. You wouldn't really remember it the next day. And to me, the really important thing about Ghost Trick is that it does blur the lines of where those things happen. And that is, to me, the new frontier in video games. And it's very exciting. It's that people have ceased to think about gameplay in such a mechanical fashion. And it still has to be good mechanically, but they also want it to be fused into these other aspects of the production. And that is pretty cool. You know, it's got to be hard to do, and it requires a lot of artistic vision, but it makes a very important impression on the player when it works.
For me, I mean, I'm not probably nearly as affected by some of these extra elements as perhaps you are. You know, I mean, I certainly enjoy Chrono Trigger a great deal on the same basis, but I probably would put the more mechanically driven games above it. One thing I would say for Zero Mission and Super Metroid, why they're so very good for my money in terms of gameplay is, of course, you know, the way you play that game, then the abilities you acquire alters the way you play it after that. You know, there's a sort of endogenous kind of nature to it, which again, ultimately, it's probably a lot more linear and set than it feels the first time around.
Right.
But that's where I think those games, in addition to just having, you know, especially Zero Mission really gets this right, you know, the handling of the character and all that stuff is just perfect in Zero Mission, but also that part of it as well. But in terms of, you know, what you're seeing now with the emphasis on narrative elements in games and all this kind of stuff, where I find it, and this goes back to what I was saying about Metal Gear right at the start of the show, where I find it to be just kind of debatable merit is where you simply mix the two without really synthesizing them together to form something new. You know, where you just plonk a 24-minute cutscene in the middle of where you play the game and then you stop playing the game and then you start playing the game again.
Yep.
That kind of mixing, I have not much interest in that whatsoever.
Sure. And you have to realize that
movies are not gameplay.
That formula and that balance in Metal Gear has not really changed since 1998. So even though Metal Gear Solid 4 is a very technically impressive game, I think it is a bit lost in the past. And I think that because it has such a rabid fan base, I think the people who love that series don't want it to move forward. I think they like it being that way because it's, at this point, it's kind of old school. You know, it was very, very fresh when the first one came out. But at this point, it's really stuck two generations before.
But where things could go, that is of interest to me, despite the fact that I'm not, you know, as sort of prone to be moved by, you know, game stories. I think that is something that I do want to see where that's going to go. And I hope that in a sense that it almost becomes even more difficult to tell where gameplay begins and ends.
Well, I think as game engines have improved, I think it's been definitely easier to do that. Like with games like Uncharted, where there still is... They still do separate a little bit, but at least it's to the point now where the game engine, you don't have to be pulled out of the game to watch the characters advance the plot.
You don't have to be, but you still are sometimes.
Yes.
Which I think they will eventually get over that. But there's a game coming out in March called Journey that I am very excited about. And I think it might do some of this blending. It might be a really good example of that going forward. So maybe we'll come back with a report on it here in a few weeks, hopefully. But anyway, let's wrap up the discussion, guys. I think it went pretty well, and I hope everyone at home enjoyed it. Please write in and let us know what you thought of this kind of thing. I mean, I'm not saying we would do this very often, but I thought, you know, it was a request from a friend. And we thought it was pretty fertile ground, and hopefully you thought so too after listening to it. But let us know what you think, and if you have any of your own thoughts on the topic, we'd certainly would love to hear those and talk back in the forums. You can send us an email, Twitter, Facebook, whatever you like. So we'd love to hear from you. Of course, the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we will be getting back to the mailbag soon. So be sure to send in those letters, and we will pick out some of the best ones to read on the show. Before we go, we do have an exciting announcement to make. We have been accepted for our third annual PAX East Live panel. That's the Penny Arcade Expo in Boston, Massachusetts, the first weekend in April. But yes, our panel, which is entitled Radio Free Nintendo Panel Edition Tridux, will take place, I just had to say it out loud to hear James groan, but it will take place on Saturday, April 7th at 11:30 a.m. in the Arachnid Theater. As of this recording, tickets are still available. The three-day passes are sold out. You did get a discount when you bought a three-day pass, but you can still buy individual daily passes, and you can, in fact, buy daily passes for all 3 days. You'll just pay a little bit more than the people who got a 3-day pass. So you can still attend the entire event. You can certainly still pick up a ticket for Saturday if you want to see our panel. There's also one the day before on Friday by the Connectivity crew. They're going to be doing live Jeopardy as a panel, and that should be very interesting. I can't wait for that. So we're going to have a sizable crew at the event. We'd love to meet you and hang out with you, talk to you about video games. We would really love for you to be in the audience for the panel. There will be, of course, live listener mail with people coming up to the microphone and asking questions. That's always an exciting part of the panel, and we will continue to do that. And I don't know who all is going to be on the panel right now, so stay tuned for the details on that. But you can head over to the website, nintendoworldreport.com, and there will be a banner there where you can click and get more details and find out what to do next if you're interested in attending. And if you are not going to be able to come, we would definitely appreciate if you could help spread the word, because the more people who show up, the more likely it is we will get to come back next year, the better time slot we get, etc. And the more people we can reach with this, you know, is actually a really good outreach opportunity for us to get people in there who've never heard the podcast before. So if you could help spread the word, if you're a member of gaming forums or just have friends who might be heading over to PAX East, let them know that we're going to be doing this and that they should come. I think it's a unique panel. I don't think there's anyone else there who's really talking about Nintendo in the way that we are, with the focus that we are. So we do try to deliver something to the people at the convention that they can't get otherwise, just like we do on the podcast every week. So yes, we are looking forward to it and very excited, and we'll have more information coming up as our plans coalesce. So we're going to wrap up the show. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo. Resize this so I can see all my notes, because I might not do them in order. I'm kind
of all of them in order.
Treating this like retroactive comments almost. Just something to sample from.
John is something to sample from.
He's a cornucopia.
Me? You're talking about me?
Where the fuck were you during that whole conversation?
I was like, all right, yeah. I mean, I'm bountiful. I'll give you that. I've been described as a feast, but.
For the eyes, primarily.
I just assumed it was a hip-hop gag.
No.
Oh, there's definitely gag involved. Hey-o!
Oh, God! That's good. That's on tape. I own 6 devices that can get Netflix Instant. I use my PS3. I think it's the best quality, and it's the best interface.
I like the 360 interface for it, until they went and made it all connecty.
Well, right.
Now, if I had a Kinect, it would be great.
The PS3 one is still the same.
I could say, Xbox, I want to watch House. And it would say, that show got canceled. And I'd be like, well, that's too bad.
But if you had Hulu Plus, you'd have access to all the catalog episodes.
That's right. And as long as my dog's not named Kinect, I'm fine.
Or your baby.
your cat named Xbox and your dog named Kinect. It's going to go badly wrong for you. But as long as you don't have that problem, you're okay.
That sounds like a great sitcom episode.
No, it doesn't. It sounds like a How I Met Your Mother episode.
Boom.
I've never seen the show. I literally have no comment whatsoever. I don't.
Craig's underscored boom. It was refined and understated. Like a fine coffee.